Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire, creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, good evening, folks. Welcome to the beautiful studios, the Big Dumb Fun Show, Studio 4, right here in Midtown Kansas City in the classic old Ice House building. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Aaron, you know, we ought to, I think you have a name for your people that follow the Big Dumb Fun Show, Fanimals.
Fanimals.
Fanimals. What's a good name for a true crime fan, a follower of Gangland Wire? A short kind of, think about
I know,
that, a catchy
I,
little name. Well, think about
we
that.
Have to
we'll
think about
we'll come
that.
Up with so something.
Maybe somebody that listens to the program can give us a suggestion.
Right. Post on my Facebook or go to make a comment on my blog. I get those comments via the email. Now, I watch Facebook all the time, my Gangland Wire Facebook page. If you ever message me or call me at 816-931-3535 and give us some suggestions. Oh, you can email me at ganglandwire. Wait a minute.
Ganglandwire.
No, correction. info@ganglandwire.com. Sorry about that. Well, anyhow.
They should have something like, I won't say they're wired, but because they're listening.
Yeah, they're wired. Yeah, they're all wired.
Somehow we can include that in the description or the short one word.
One word. We'll think about it.
I don't know.
That may not be it.
Ganglandimals? No.
Ganglandimals? No, that's not it.
No one wants to be called that.
All right.
People barely want to be called a fanimal.
Really?
Until they realize that Nickelodeon was also using that term recently.
Oh, really? Our people do not want to be called fanimals. I'll tell you that right now.
I'm already using that term. I'd hope you'd find another. But, I can't stop you.
Oh, I understand.
Hold on a second. There, your mic is going down. Okay. So, if you love the Big Dumb Fun Show, and who doesn't? Because this studio is where we do Gangland Wire from and the Big Dumb Fun Show. Go to BigDumbFunShow.com or use the shortcut, BDFS.TV.
All right. Well, tonight, Aaron, we have a call-in guest. We have former detective Jim Paydar. I was kidding with him that's the Northwest Missouri nasal twang country way of saying a word. So it's Jim Paydar. Jim, would you say hello to everybody?
Hi, folks. How you doing?
Jim is retired from the Chicago Police Department, and he has a blog. It is www.onbeingacop. That's onbeingacop.com. And he has a book out there that the title is On Being a Cop. It was written by Jim and his son, Jay Paydar. You can find that at their website and buy it from them directly and probably get an autographed copy. Or I think you can go to Amazon.
Absolutely.
Can you go to Amazon, I suppose?
Yes, you can.
If you
order it from the website, you get an autographed copy.
Yeah, that's what I thought. And I suppose there's a Kindle version. Can you sell a Kindle version off your website?
Yeah, no, you have to buy the Kindle from whoever your ebook provider is.
It's on
iTunes, it's on Nook, it's on all the major formats, but you're best off to go to whoever your favorite provider is of ebooks.
Okay, a lot of people don't even read hard copy books anymore. If you can't get it in an ebook, they don't get it. It's been my experience.
Right. Right. No, we have an ebook out there for sure.
All right, good. Well, I first ran across you, Jim, by just noodling around on Chicago mob stuff and Chicago outfit stuff and Chicago crime stories, and I found your blog, and it was really interesting. It's well written and really held my attention. And of course, our Gangland Wire, we are kind of primarily focused on the La Cosa Nostra mafia, in which we have a family here in Kansas City, and you have one in Chicago. They call it the Outfit in Chicago. And, of course, there's one in Cleveland and
right.
Milwaukee, and New York has the five families. And so there's the New England mob. I'm not sure New Jersey. I think there's probably still something down in southern Florida. And we've always had a mafia family, the Carlos Marcello family down in New Orleans. So they're kind of all over, and there's a lot of interest in it. People love mob stories. They love The Sopranos and kind of revitalized the interest in it after The Godfather really stirred it up back in the 80s, or is it the 80s, I think, or 70s. late was it 70s, a long time ago. Well, The Godfather really revitalized that genre.
Yes, it did, yes.
So anyhow, you know, let me ask you a few questions about yourself, Jim, let the people get to know you a little bit. Now, how long were you a Chicago police officer?
I was a sworn officer for 29 years, a little over... Almost 30 years, 29 years and 9 months.
And what units did you primarily work in?
I spent the majority of my street time in Area 4 homicide. I, of course, like all coppers, I came up through the ranks as a police officer, and then I was a tactical officer, and then got promoted to detective. And I wound up in the detective division for 11 years as a homicide detective, before being promoted to a sergeant. And in Chicago, when you're promoted to a sergeant, you have to move. So, but I look back on my police career, and if I could repeat any part of it, I'd repeat the 11 years in homicide, because those were interesting, challenging, and people take exception to this, but they were fun. They were fun years.
Can you tell us what years you served for the 29 years, 9 months?
I joined the department in 1966, okay. And I retired in August of 1995.
So
that's kind of the thick of it for.
Yes, it was. You saw a lot of stuff. You came. I guess you were there for the 1968 Democratic National Convention, then, weren't you? You got some stories about that, I'll bet.
Yes, we do, and. Actually, before that, we were in the Cabrini housing projects for the Martin Luther King riots.
Oh, that's right. There were.
So
that was when Martin Luther King. I remember. I just saw that on a public television show. Martin Luther King, or after Martin Luther King, I think was the title of it, and they talked about him coming up out of the South. Always before he'd been in the South, and they came up to Chicago. And led a march, I think, into a primarily white neighborhood. Was that what it was?
Yes.
And you were
yes, you did, yeah.
And you were working tactical at that point?
I was not assigned to that particular march, and it turned out to be fairly uneventful. I mean, it was not a major issue. There were some minor skirmishes along the way, and a lot of catcalling. But the march itself was well policed. I wasn't one of them at the time.
And of course, the riots in was that 1968 also? I believe it was, wasn't it? After Martin Luther King was killed.
Yes, it was April of 1968.
April of
1968. April of 68 was the King riots, and in September was the Democratic National Convention. So, and at that point in my police career, I just had 2 years on the job, so it was. Truly baptism under fire.
That's for sure.
And I was lucky enough to come out of it without a scratch in either one of those.
And some great stories.
Those stories aren't much fun as some of the others, though. Now, I understand
now,
that.
For people that aren't from Chicago and might not know, you said you were working Area 4 for homicide. What? I don't know what that area would be comprised of.
Yeah, Area 4, at the time I worked homicide, worked out of the Maxwell Street Station. And the Maxwell Street Station is the station that was used for the opening credits on Hill Street Blues. So if you see, if you have a memory of any old Hill Street Blues mm-hmm. series, they always open with a shot of the Maxwell Street homicide office. And we largely handled the city's west side from the edge of the city at the Chicago River all the way out to the city limits, the west side. We used to call it the west side, the worst side.
So that's kind of was mob country back in those days in the 60s and early 70s, wasn't it? The Grand Avenue
yes,
crew, Joey
along,
Lombardo.
We included what they call Little Italy along Taylor Street.
Yeah.
And that was part of our area. We got our share of bodies from Little Italy, but we got probably the majority of our cases farther, a little bit farther west from the ghetto. Although the mob was certainly active, and every once in a while a body would pop up somewhere.
Like in the Chicago River?
Did they put that bodies in the Chicago River?
Chicago River.
If that was a demarcation line, how would you decide who got the case, if it was on the south side of the bank or the north side?
Why, here's how you decided. Whichever guy pushed it back to the other side. It's whoever got there first and had a pole long enough to push the body back to the other side.
See, this is one of those homicide detectives that they find a body with about six arrows in the back, and he says, looks like suicide. Cleared this case.
Well, we weren't that bad, but we did have jurisdictional differences from time to time.
Oh, I know you did. We had them down here, too.
Especially a demarcation line like that.
We used to take homeless guys, and if they got a call on them, somebody wanted us to do something with them, give them a ride over to state line and say, get out and start walking into Kansas, and then Kansas could then call Kansas, let them deal with it.
Well,
the Chicago River being a boundary was kind of problematic because it was a, how shall we say, a fluid boundary line. So there were...
Are you from Chicago?
Oh, I was born and raised in Chicago.
Lifelong
resident of Chicago.
West Side?
Near Northwest Side. For people who we lived in what they call Gale Street district. So that's on the near Northwest Side of Chicago. Hmm. That's where I was born and raised, and then eventually wound up moving way to the far Northwest Side where I'm at now. I don't have to live in the city anymore, but I've lived here for many, many years. And, of course, it's every copper's desire to get out of the city. But when I bought the property up here, my back fence is the Skokie city limits. So I'm in Chicago, but if you throw a ball across my back fence, it lands in Skokie. I've gone about as far as I can go.
I know in Kansas City, if you serve on the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department, don't you have to live inside the city limits?
Yeah, you have to live inside the city limits.
Probably the same in Chicago?
Yes, yes. As long as you're any type of city employee, you have to live in the city.
Now, and your son also serves on the police force as well. Was your father on the police force?
No. I was the first one in the family to... join the police department, and I was kind of what I call an accidental cop, because my vocation was an electrical engineer, and I moved for a short time out to New York City and worked as a research and development electrical engineer, where I discovered that as an electrical engineer I sucked, and I came back to Chicago and got a job in more of administrative engineering, and just on a lark, just on an absolute lark, I took the police exam, just out of interest, and I wound up scoring number one on the exam, and it was front page news, and I had to go in and explain to my boss that I really didn't mean it, but he was a he was a cool guy. He says, listen, Jim, he says, you're single. That's the time I was single. He says, you're single. He says, you have no family obligations. He says, why don't you try it? He says, if you don't like it, he says, you can come back. So I did. I tried it and never looked back.
And you liked it, didn't you? You liked
it. Oh, I loved it.
You liked
absolutely
the action.
Loved it,
yes.
Yeah.
Anybody that stays likes the action. You don't really do it for many other reasons other than personal satisfaction, and you like action.
not only that, but, you know, every day is different. Every day you go out there, you have no idea what's going to happen or how it's going to be.
That's true.
And that's what makes the job so interesting.
Sometimes it's long, boring hours followed by moments of sheer terror, but it's always different and it's always interesting. You know,
always different, exactly. So
you are quite a writer too. You're a very skillful writer. I'm impressed with your writing abilities. I wish I could do that well. I have to write and rewrite and rewrite and
and he's got to get another pair of shoes because he's grinding his feet into the floor while he's writing.
I do that too. My toes are hurt. I'll sit there and compose something and I realize that, well, I'll stand up. My toes will be hurting because I'm gripping.
Writing kind of runs in our family. My mother was a great writer. My aunt was a great writer. And now my son behind me, he's a very good writer. And so it's always been, writing has never been a chore for me. It's always been an enjoyable experience. So it's worked out well for me.
So you were the guy that didn't mind writing the police report when everybody else was trying to shove them off onto you. No, policemen usually, historically, do not like to write reports.
My partner and I hate to brag, but we were the master report writers in homicide.
Yeah, you were the guys that could do it.
And the case we're going to talk about, the very first report on that case was 9 typewritten pages. And at the time we wrote it, we didn't really know who the victims were or who did the caper, you know. So, and we still filled up 9 pages.
Wow.
So,
you know, we're going to talk one more little thing about writing the blog that you and your son wrote, and you co-wrote this book. How did you get started doing that, and how did you guys happen to start collaborating on that writing?
Yeah, that's an interesting story. I had at that point in my career, I had moved over to the 911 system as Midnight's operations manager, and my son was a brand new recruit working the north side of Chicago, and he was, at the time, he was a bachelor living alone, and he would get home from his tour of duty at 8:30 in the morning. And if you've ever worked a midnight shift, especially in an active district, you come home and you're full of adrenaline, and there's no way you can go to sleep. And if you've got a wife or a girlfriend or a spouse or someone you can talk about, that's great. He didn't have anyone like that, so he'd sit down and write me an email about what happened during the night. And I started reading this stuff. I thought, this stuff is pretty darn good, you know. And so I emailed him back. I says, I'll tell you what, Jay. I says, for every story you write, I'll write one. So we did that for 6 or 7 years. Now, we didn't write every night because every night wasn't exciting, you know. But at the end of 6, 7, 8 years, we had quite a stack of stories. And people who knew about what we were doing wanted to see copies of the stories. So we started the blog, and then on the blog, people who ran across the blog kept on telling us we should do a book, we should do a book. So a couple years ago, we did. We sat down and took the stories and put them together, 53 stories, all true cases of stuff that my son and I handled. And we published a book on being a cop. And the book is a bit different from what's on the blog. Because we had a publishing coach, and he says, you know, you really need a story about your other boys. I got 3 other boys. And so we had to write stories that included them in some way or another. And the book does have family stories in it. It's part of the book's goal is to make human beings out of policemen.
Interesting, yeah.
So you'll find some family stories in there or how certain things on the job affect you in your home life. And so people who've read it really enjoy the book. It's a little bit different than most cop books because it does really involve the family and family relationships. And in addition, mostly police stories, mostly cop stuff.
All right. Well, you know, we speaking of that, we have a interesting police cop story tonight for you guys. Now, you've already heard kind of my telling. I just went over Jim's blog and kind of told this story from a third-party person, and then I got hold of Jim, and I said, would you like to come on the show and give us your version, a first-party version to the story about a couple of bodies that were found in a 55-gallon drums in a small sandwich shop called the Corner Sandwich Shop in was the west side of Chicago. So, Jim, why don't you start telling our folks about, you know, kind of how you got that call that night. You remember the sergeant coming. You were a detective then, you and your partner, and you're probably hanging out in the squad room, and the sergeant comes in and says, hey, we got a call. We got a place for you to go.
It was a Friday. It was July 5th, 1974. My partner and I were working the midnight shift. The midnight shift in Chicago starts at 12:30 a.m., and we got into the office a little bit before that. And my partner and I were one homicide team, and we had another homicide team working that night. Now, being that it was a holiday weekend and it was a warm summer night, and they used to call Area 4 the murder factory, we were almost sure to get a homicide sometime during the night. And right before the roll call was very informal, you know, there were only four of us, and the sergeant came in and said, listen, we got a call. There's a body in a garbage can. And he kind of looked at the four of us expectantly to see, you know, who's going to volunteer for it. And my partner popped up his head, and he says, we'll take it, Sarge. And I kind of looked at him questioningly, like, you know, oh, really? And he said, okay, it's yours. So we got out in the car, and I told my partner, I says, can you explain to me why we took this case? And he took the part of the very impatient teacher. He says, because it's not going to be a body. It's summertime. It's going to be a dog or rotten meat or something like that. And then we've had our first case for the night, and the next one that comes in goes to the other team.
And it'll be a real one. They'll be tied up all night long.
Yeah, exactly.
Was he a more experienced officer?
Well, we got over to the corner. we got over to the corner shop, and the minute we pulled up, we knew it was not a dog in a garbage can, because there was a squad roll, there were two patrol cars and a sergeant's car. The lights were on in the shop, and they had already put a call in for the crime lab. So we said, oh boy, this is the real deal. And the minute we walked into the shop, we were hit by that pungent odor that every police officer knows, the decaying body. The sergeant was at the back of the shop in the kitchen, and the owner of the shop, not the owner, but the guy who was operating the shop, a guy named Tony Russo, was sitting at the counter. The sergeant took us into the back room, and it was a little storage area in the back corner of the kitchen, really kind of an obscure door. And when you open that door, there were two 55-gallon drums in there, and the police officers had taken the drums were very tightly sealed. They had been lined with plastic, and then the bodies had been put into the drums. And then the lids were put onto the drum over the plastic, and then the bolt rings were securely fastened on both drums. So they were very, very securely sealed. We found out from the owner that he and his wife had been, or the operator, I should say, he and his wife had been kind of vexed over the summer months by this slight putrid odor that they couldn't put their finger on. And she was really starting to get at him. She said, we have to find that odor. They took the kitchen apart. They cleaned everything. They got behind the counters. They got under the sinks, and they couldn't find anything. And that night he was at home in bed. His wife had gone to sleep, and he was staring at the ceiling, and he remembered his days as a corpsman in the United States Navy. and he had worked with many of decomposed bodies then, and he sat bolt upright in bed. He says, "My God," he says, "that's the smell of a body." So he got out of bed quietly, went down to the shop, turned on a little light in the back. He didn't want anyone to know he was there, and opened up one of the drums. And sticking up at the top of the drum were 2 feet, clothed in galoshes. Now, this is July 5th, and it's in the middle of summer, and this individual that's in this drum is wearing winter clothing. When the police got there, they opened up the other drum, and it looked like a big bundle of clothing, but it was winter clothing, heavy, heavy woolen overcoat of some kind. We couldn't see much more than that. But from the smell, we knew there was certainly, you know, decaying human flesh here.
So you knew they'd been there for a while, didn't you? This guy that ran the shop.
Well, I assume because of the galoshes.
Really? This guy that ran the shop, Tony Russo, now, he didn't own it. A guy named Sam Rantis owned it. Did you know anything about the owners or Russo? Or, I mean, what was your kind of your initial suspicion when you find that this is so unusual? I mean, I know you and your partner and those policemen there may be the only people that ever found a scene quite like this.
Did he mention the Baby Ruth box?
This is one of the most bizarre scenes I had ever come across.
I can imagine. What did this guy say? Well, I mean, is he just saying, "I don't know, man. It wasn't me."
Well, he told us that he knew Sam Rantis, and that Sam Rantis was dead. Sam Rantis's body had been found December 7th, the year before. December 7th of 74, and Sam Rantis's wife asked him if he could take over the shop and operate it for her. So he says, "My wife and I were just operating the shop for the last several months for the widow Rantis." And he says, we were disturbed by this smell, but we really didn't know what it was. He repeated the story I just told you. He was laying in bed that night, and he says, "I know what that is." He says, "That's a body." So he came back and opened up. He didn't know that drums were there. He had never looked in that little corner door. It was a door under a stairwell, and it was kind of obscure. And if you opened the door, it was stacked floor to ceiling with empty bread racks. So even at opening the door, you couldn't see anything. But he opened the door, and he thought the smell was a little bit stronger, so he started taking out the bread racks, and that's when he saw the 2 55-gallon drums.
So now you know that there's 2 dead bodies that have been there quite a while. The guy that owned the shop, possibly when those guys were first deposited there, is dead himself. You have a real whodunit on your hands here, don't you?
Oh, for sure. We don't, and I... Sam Rantis was the owner of the shop, and I knew nothing about Sam Rantis at that time. Down the line a ways, the bodies, which had been in that drum for over 9 months, were barely recognizable, so we didn't know who they were. We had a stone-cold mystery on our hands.
So, I mean, did you have it? You remember having any kind of inclination? Well, you know, what happened here was, you know, did you think maybe it's just one suspect that killed both these guys and left them there and took Rantis out and killed him, or did you have any idea at all?
Perfect. To be perfectly honest with you, we didn't have any idea what had happened, and there was even some discussion as to what were in the drums. The one drum, there were 2 feet sticking up with rubber boots on, and the other drum was just kind of looked like a mound of clothing. So did we have one body that was cut in half and put in each drum, or did we have 2 separate bodies, or we didn't know what we had. So the sergeant on the scene suggested that we empty the drums out in the kitchen there. We were kind of incredulous. We says, "What?
Kind of destroying all the evidence."
"We don't know." He says, "Where are you going to go with this? We're going to take it to the morgue." He says, "You can't take it to the morgue. They have to be pronounced first." And I said, "Well, we'll work around that. We'll figure out how to handle that." And I said, "You can't empty these drums in this guy's kitchen." And so he looks down at his sleeve. He says, "Well, last time I looked, I was a sergeant and you're a detective." He says, "So I guess I win."
What was Mr. Russo saying during this time?
Russo's out at the counter saying, no, don't empty the drums in my kitchen."
I could imagine.
Get that guy out of here. Get him out front, you know. So right at that moment in Chicago on the off hours, the representative of the superintendent of police is what we call a street deputy. And there's always a street deputy on the street 24 hours a day to handle big cases like this. And right at that moment, a fellow street deputy by the name of Bill Keating walks in. And Bill Keating had once been the commander of homicide, citywide commander of homicide. So Mike and I knew him well. And in fact, he came walking in. He says, "Jimmy, Mike," he says, "what do you guys got here?" And the sergeant looked, you know, like, ooh, you know, first name with the deputy. And my personal habit, I never call a ranking member of the department by his first name if there's other officers present. I don't care how well I know him. Out of respect for his rank, if he has a rank, I'll address him by his rank. But I thought, well, this called for a little bit of an exception. So I said, "Hey, Bill," I says, "how you doing?" I says, and I explained to him what we had. And so then the sergeant got into it. "You know, you can't take it to the morgue until it's pronounced." And the deputy, Bill Keating, said, "Well," he says, "I think my guys can handle it." Mm-hmm. So he says, we'll load the drums in the wagon. And he says, my guys will handle it.
Interesting. So, now, I have a question about that. Was there a rule that a body had to be pronounced dead at the scene if it was dead before you took it away? Or what was in that? Why was that sergeant so adamant about dumping these bodies out? I mean, you wouldn't have to dump them out to say they're dead. You could smell them and say they were dead.
Yeah, but his point was we didn't know whether we had one body or two bodies or three bodies cut to pieces. We didn't know what we had.
Oh, okay. All right. He wanted to find out what you had.
And that was his point. I mean, we knew for sure they were dead. And we knew for sure that we didn't have the controls we would need in that kitchen. And the best place to do the unpacking would be at the Cook County Morgue.
Oh, yeah, you'd contaminate the bodies. You contaminate any evidence, all the evidence
right
now
was
confined within the drum. The kitchen and the storeroom and area had been cleaned many times since they were killed, but you'd then put fresh contamination on those bodies. So, yeah, I understand.
Whatever you had, it was all contained in the drums.
At least that's what you knew now.
Yeah.
You hadn't found the Baby Ruth box yet, had you? You hadn't found the legs.
No, that comes a little bit.
Are we going to tease that here for the next episode?
Later. We've got something coming up. You know, Jim, we're gonna cut out. We're up about 30 minutes. I do a little public service announcement, and then we will come back with a second episode of this exciting story. What did you came up with a name for this case? Lots of times. I remember doing that. We'd call it like the River Hills Caper, you came up with a name for this case. What name did you come up with?
We came up with the name Janitors in a Drum.
Janitors in a Drum. That's pretty good.
When we come back, I'll tell you how we came up with that name.
Okay. All right, Jim. Thank you. And we will be back with more, Jim, later on in the next episode. And this brings me to my usual public service announcement. I have long supported the nonprofit First Call. If you have a friend, relative, child, grandchild, spouse, parent, or anybody you care about has a problem with addiction, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. And I understand that a lot of you listeners are not in Kansas City. But if you want any questions answered like that, I promise you they will answer your questions. So they have resources on their website, and you can talk to somebody. That's a 24-hour-a-day manned hotline. Aaron, what do you got to say to that?
And remember to buy or rent the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available on Amazon. Also, you want to download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. For $1.99, you can take your own personal tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City.
Oh, and a lot of our music I've been throwing in here, not the front and the back, but in the middle. I'll use a little music to kind of separate out the different segments. That's from one of our great fans, Casey McBride. Casey and I both are administrators with Craig Timmons from England and several other kind of mob, shall we say, experts on the National Crime Syndicate Facebook page. That's a really interesting mob-oriented Facebook page. They have stuff from about the mob from all over the world, really, from England and Italy and New York and Chicago and L.A. and Kansas City, Cleveland, and Milwaukee. So check that out, and we appreciate it, Casey McBride. I think that's all I got. You got anything else, Aaron?
I don't know when this episode's going up, but you might want to mention you're going to be in Las Vegas for Mob History Month.
I will be in Las Vegas in January, the 10th. I think it's on the 10th. It's just go to the Clark County Library website. Though it's Mob History Month in January, and I'm going to do a program with my new book. My new book called Leaving Vegas is going to be coming out pretty quick. All right. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Jim.
Yeah, goodnight.
Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.